2 hour delay anyways before we take off. We're at 5 hours anyways. I'm like, I might as well just drive.
Yeah. Same thing for this trip that we just took. It's a 2.5 hour drive.
Amazing the power. I'll share it with you.
Please.
It's 9 o'clock. Everybody here. It's 9 a.m. on Friday, August 21st. We're going to call our meeting to order. We have almost a full complement. We have a new member, Diane Morgenthaler, who was supposed to take her oath of office today, but she had a conflict, so she won't join us until November. But we do have a full complement, so it's good to see everybody. I'm going to ask you to join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
It's over here. They moved it.
Oh, my God.
To the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
They talked to our prank. I don't think that might be a prank. Why is it over there?
Sorry, yeah. When did they move
the flag? I have no idea. It's the first time in the years I've been here. It's over there. Sorry about that, Rabbi. That was just for you.
Can I have a motion for an objection to whoever moved the flag?
Who moved the flag?
Yeah, we'll find.
Really? You know?
Yeah.
It's always been there.
Always.
You work for
this. Yes, sir. I'm going to find out.
Yeah, this is very important.
You all stood up and faced that direction.
I'm going to lay this on Isaac.
Away from the
oh, boy. Before we get to public comment, just a few changes in today's meeting. I've already spoken about Ms. Morgenthaler not being here. I look forward to meeting her at the November meeting. Our plant administrator, Scott Bauer, has a conflict this morning on Florida's East Coast. One of his pension boards needed him to be there, so he had to make a choice. So he sent us Toby Ribello. Toby, welcome. We're glad to have you here. Toby is a former pension board chair. Got to be careful. And he was also a member of Miami Beach Police Department. So we welcome you on two accounts, and we thank you for your service. It's occurred to me as I was reading the minutes, and we'll get to the minutes in a minute, that we've been remiss in leaving one name off of these records. I went back. We simply couldn't function without Sue Smith, Longboat Key's finance director. She and I are always in contact, but everything that we do here during our meetings, the smoothness of the operation, the coordination of our team, our investment consultant, TJ Lowe of Greystone, our actuary, Doug Lozen of Foster & Foster, our attorney, Ron Cohn, I think it's Ron Cohn who's here today, of Lorium Law. He shaved. I mean,
I was wondering who that was then.
By Gillette. And Scott Bauer, our administrator from the resource centers. They all come here. We never have any doubts. You know, we know they're going to be here. But it would not be seamless if it wasn't for Sue. So, Toby, please, in the record of this meeting, show that Sue Smith is in the house. Thank you. Is there any public here for comments? I've been on this board for a long time, and I don't think I have met public for very many times, but I guess we have to have it here. We get to the approval of the minutes from the May 15th meeting. I'm assuming that you read it over. I've got a few things on page 3 that stuck out at me. The first thing, and I need you, TJ, for this, on the second paragraph where it says investment consultant, Theodore Lowe offered to bring long-term return expectations based on the current asset allocation particularly with possible structural shifts in the market driven by geopolitical events, interest rate expectation, and AI themes. You got that for us today?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good. Good. And then if you go down to paragraph, I guess it's 4, Mr. DeCara questioned why the board should not hold the benchmark instead of Kent. There's something missing here. It's not the board holding the benchmark instead of Kennedy. It was another group. That sentence doesn't make any sense to me.
Rabbi, where are you?
I'm in the 4th paragraph. Mr. DeCaro questioned why the board should not hold the benchmark instead of Kennedy.
The trustees not hold
You're asking about passive investments. Why should it be passive? So it could be, rather than should not hold the benchmark, maybe you should not invest in passive instead of Kennedy.
Okay.
Should be investing in passive. Correct.
Be in passive.
Right. So we'll make that correction. Should invest in passive instead of Kennedy.
Thank you so much. Okay. Those are the only questions that I had. Anybody else have additions, changes to the minutes? Hearing none, do I have a motion to accept the minutes as changed?
Yeah, motion to approve with the amendments.
Thank you. Second?
Second.
Second. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Passed. Thank you. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. We have 8, so it's 8-0. Okay. All right, TJ, you're up.
Well, Rabbi, you set me up perfect because we're going to pick up kind of where we left off from last quarter, talking about two things, focusing on two things. One, the active first passive piece that we talked about, especially in the small and mid-cap space. We've been in this risk on or a beta type of market for the last 12 to 36 months. And because of that risk on nature, we've created the portfolio to be a risk-off portfolio, meaning we continue or we participate in up markets with a focus on downside protection. That's the managers we've used. So when we're in a risk-on type of environment, a beta-driven environment, like we've been in specifically the last 12 months, we have seen some performance below the benchmark for our managers. We brought data to back up. Yes, we've seen this before, but we have seen outperformance from these managers up until about the last 12 months. We'll also talk about the asset allocation. Doug was here last quarter talking about the actuarial target. We're talking, is 6.75 the right target for us for the long term? We're showing what our expected return is. So we'll go through the investment piece a little bit quicker, meaning we're not going to focus on each manager. We're going to focus detail on the mid and small cap managers. So we'll go talk about the market, the economy, how did the portfolio do, briefly highlight a few of the managers, and then dive into the deeper dive. Does that sound good, Rabbi?
Yep. I've been waiting.
Wonderful. So page 2 under the first tab, what has changed this market, in this market? A lot. A lot has changed this quarter, not only since the end of the quarter, but during this last quarter. I was headlining the beginning of the quarter saying, more, what more? As that came off the table during the second quarter, but now it's on again, off again, on again, the straits open, the straits close, we're resolving this, but today we all know that it is not resolved. But what has changed in the second quarter is pretty interesting. As equity owners, we own stocks in our portfolio. For the last several years, what has driven stock market return is the price investors were willing to pay for earnings. If we look at the left-hand side of page 2, how do we get an investment return by owning stocks? There's 3 ways. On the left-hand side is the typical way, through earnings growth, the companies are doing better, and return of some of that earnings through dividends. So over the last, from 2023 to 2025, earnings plus the dividends were close to just over 8% returns. But what was the outsized piece? What was really driving the stock market for those 3 years was that multiple, that price to earnings, the valuation. The easy way to think of that is if a company earned $1 of earnings, but it's trading for 10, the multiple is 10. Well, that 10 expanded by 14% over that three-year period. That's pretty high. We typically see that lower single digits rather than a 14 mid-teen return. But what that did for that three-year period was drive stocks up 23% annualized. What changed this year is multiples have contracted this year, specifically during the last quarter. Why? If we go and look at the right-hand side of page two, and we look at that blue bar, earnings expectations and earnings, what we saw during the second quarter, were up 27, 28%. That's really, really strong earnings. And earnings over the long term matter. If we go to the middle section where the multiple is, it's hard to see that number in there. But multiples, that price to earnings, contracted 18% during the second quarter. So investors were not willing to pay as much for the earnings. We saw that contract. We think that's healthy. Why is that healthy? If we go to the next page, left-hand side is pretty busy. Let's look at the right-hand side of page three. Multiples have contracted from historic highs, about 22 times earnings, down to 20. That's that reduction we just talked about, that 18% reduction in multiples. We think that's healthy. Now, is it back to long-term averages of 18 times, 16 to 18 times earnings? No, but the direction matters. We're starting to see that come in as our earnings are picking up. And what's driving earnings is on page four. We've been talking about the Magnificent Seven, Google, Amazon, Tesla, NVIDIA, Apple, Microsoft, for the last 3-4 years. And they really drove the market higher. So if you look at the left-hand side of this page, that's the first quarter of 2025. The Mag 7, those seven stocks, their earnings, year-over-year growth, was 37%. The rest, the other 493, their earnings growth was 3%. Stagnant, muted. That theme continues into the second quarter, the third quarter, the fourth quarter, the first quarter of 26. And now what we're seeing going into the second quarter is now that other 493 is starting to increase and starting to see earnings growth in the rest of the market. Looking forward, the market's anticipating that to continue to have strong growth. So we're seeing a rotation out of those Magnificent Seven. We're seeing some sell-off in the AI side of the equation. We're still back to that show-me-the-money phase. Still a lot of spend there, but we're asking now. We want to see profitability. And what's changed since the end of the second quarter is into this quarter, value continues to do well. We're starting to see companies and managers and investors focus on free cash flow. What does that mean? We don't want just to see companies investing in AI. We want to see profitability in those margins increase. So when we come back next quarter, our managers look really good in the quarter we're in right now, the third quarter. Second quarter was kind of that back beta still strategy. Everybody was back into the markets after a sell-off. But we're starting to see quality matter. We're seeing AI not be front and center. And the question again, like we saw in the first quarter, show me the money. We want to see profitability. We want to see margins improve. So we think this has been a healthy rotation. And you know, the thesis of, well, is there an AI bubble and is there going to be a burst of the bubble? If you turn on the news, everybody's talking about it. We talked about it last quarter as well. Usually when everybody's talking about it, we're not there yet. And if we go back to 1996, the Fed chair came out and said, equity markets are overpriced. That was 1996. It took 4 years until we saw those markets start to sell off and have a recession and then what we call a bubble burst. So are we there? Potentially, there is still risks in the market. There's still concentration in the market overall. But we're seeing some of that deflate a little bit with the second quarter, particularly hard for the third quarter as well. Page five, because we're going to talk about asset allocation, I'd like to remind everybody what we're trying to accomplish over the long term and why do we pick different asset classes. This is a quill chart of all the different asset classes, or the most asset classes, we'll say, going back to 2017. Why do we have a diversified portfolio? I'd like to start off on the top left, where emerging markets was up 37-38% in 2017. The next year, they went from the top, being the best performing asset group, to the bottom, worst asset performing group. Up a little bit, near the top again, as we go over time, at the bottom, near the top. So asset classes change, leadership changes, but what's been consistent over the last several years is large cap growth has been at the top. We're now seeing it now, not at the top, but now large cap value is for the last 12 months. So what we do is we're more like that white box in the middle. We stay towards the middle. We're always going to apologize about something. We're never going to be in the white asset class all the time. We're never going to be able to pick it because if we follow and chase returns, it falls to the next to the bottom. We try to smooth returns over the long term to get to that 6 3/4 target of our actuary. Page 6. I just included this just to remind people we are getting, I think we all know, as we're getting text messages and everything else from every political candidate, polls to our phones now. It's incredible, but what? Just a reminder, there could be some market volatility as we are in the election season. Typically during a second year of a term of a president, markets tend to be a little bit sideways as we are in the midterm election season. I think we got a little bit ahead of that, but I think as news comes out, polls come out, could be change of Congress, Senate, could create some volatility. Just here really as a reminder, we are in political season. Political season does create some volatility, but I think that's what we'll be talking about in November when we come back post-election. But with that, with equity markets strong and strong earnings over the last quarter, if we go to page 7 and we look at the first benchmark, the S&P 500, up 15% in a quarter. It's incredible. Investors ignored the Iran conflict. They've ignored this jump up in inflation. They ignored and got through the oil spike, again, on the back of strong earnings. On the back of semi-resolve of an Iran conflict, semi-resolve on the oil prices as they've come down from 120 and now settled around $80 a barrel. Looking forward, they said earnings matter over the long term. We're still seeing strong earnings growth. So strong recovery for the quarter puts the year to date at 10%. But look at that 12-month number, third column in on the S&P 500, up 22%. Working down that 12-month column, we go down to the fourth benchmark. The Russell 1000 value is up 28% above the growth benchmark at 18. So we're seeing value, CVS's, Walmart's, do better than the NVIDIA's, Google's, Amazon's in the world right now. But the outliers, the third from the bottom, Russell 2000 index, those are those small cap companies, up 40%, 41 almost, for the last 12 months. Small cap has done very well as we've seen a rotation from the large cap AI companies. Speculators said, where else could we see this? What is AI adjacent? Where can we get returns we haven't seen yet? And there's been a rotation into these small cap companies, and that has boosted them up 41% over the last 12 months. The bottom of the page is a complete reversal of last quarter. Technology was due to the worst. It is now the best, up 32% for the quarter. The worst is energy, down 13% for the quarter as we saw oil prices come down a little bit. Page 8, international markets, Ryan. Up, just not in 2025, we talked about international was a better asset class, performed better than U.S. equities. For the quarter, the MSCI EAFE, first benchmark on page 8, was up 10, almost 11, compared to the S&P up 15 for the quarter. And over the last 12 months, up 20% versus 22% for the S&P 500. So, did well, performed well, kept up, not as strong as U.S. markets. But what has done well on the international side is at the bottom of this page, emerging markets. If we look at the last 12 months, the MSCI EM benchmark's up 44%. And people think about EM, the first thing that pops to mind is usually China. China is actually negative. China has unemployment problems, about 25% unemployment rate for working age individuals, let's say 25 and 40-year-olds. They have deflation pressure, they have growth issues. So China's been very volatile. They did well about a year ago, but now they've sold off as more data is coming out. But the outliers, two below China, or three below, it's at the bottom of that page. Second from the bottom, you'll see 105.87 for the 12-month return for Taiwan. By Taiwan, Taiwan Semiconductor, one of the biggest semiconductor producers in the world, AI, continues to drive markets higher. So on over 100% in the last 12 months. Interesting part of the market is on the next page, page 9. It's been interesting over the last week, specifically this year, is fixed income markets. You know, fixed income was boring for a long period of time, but it's been an exciting asset class as we, there's volatility. If we look on page 9, the first benchmark is the 90-day T-bill. That's cash, what we can get in money markets, CDs. The second benchmark is the Bloomberg U.S. aggregate. If we look for the quarter, bonds, or that second benchmark, is below cash. We look for the year-to-date, bonds are below cash. In the last 12 months, bonds are below cash. For every time period, measuring, bonds have been below cash for the last decade. We saw a reverse of that last quarter. We're seeing bonds do better over the last at the end of last year. But what we've seen since the end of 2025 through the end of June, it continued into the third quarter, is interest rates have been going up. We went from 4% to over 4.5% on a 10-year treasury. It's now between 4.6, creeping up to 4.7, coming down a little bit. And then we're seeing the 30-year interest rates rise as well. So we're seeing a steepening of the yield curve, meaning short-term rates are lower than the 2-year, the 5-year, the 10, and 30 years are now the most highest interest rate. So why do we see a negative or a return lower for bonds than cash? I'd like to remind everybody that when interest rates go up, the price of our bonds go down. Let's say we bought a 4% bond yesterday, and we need that money back. We need that $1,000 to go buy something for our house. So we have to go sell it today, but all of a sudden interest rates went from 4 to 4.5. So today they're at 4.5. We're getting paid 4%. The rabbi's like, I need my money back. So we go to the market, and he's trying to sell it to Isaac. Isaac's like, I have $1,000, I'll buy it from you. But I can go to the bank right now and get it for 4.5%. So to make Isaac want to buy the rabbi's bond, the rabbi discounts his bond, so Isaac gets that 4.5%. That's why we see that inverse relationship as bond prices go, yields go up. And that's what we've seen so far for this year and continued into the third quarter. Now, Walsh, the new Fed chair, came out yesterday, talked about a bond purchasing program. You know, maybe we can put some liquidity in this market and keep a cap on yields. The front end of the curve like that. The long end of the curve, those 30 years, still increased yesterday. So there is still some waiting. There's some worry about long-term ability to continue to pay our debts. As we see our debt continue to increase, there's worry still about inflation over the long term. So there's still a lot of question marks. But at the same time, we had some earnings announcements from some big producers, some big companies, and they're seeing some weakness in the economy. So how do we fight those two things? We have inflation above 3% still. We have a 2% target. Now at the same time, we're seeing some weakness in the economy. To fight the inflation, we increase rates. To help with the economy, we reduce rates. Walsh has come out and said, you know, our mandate is both of these. We really want to focus on inflation still over the long run. Employment's been okay, still strong. But we're going to be a little bit more tight-lipped about what we're going to do in the future. So I think everything's going to come down to data dependency. We're going to continue to monitor interest rates. If interest rate surprises come out, I think it's going to move the market significantly. I don't think Walsh is going to come out and show his hand as much as Powell has in the past. So there could continue to be some drift up in rates over the next several months. Our take is over the next 6 months. By the end of this year, we don't think there's going to be a rate increase. We think some of this inflation that came in from the oil spike will work itself out. We're seeing housing prices come down. We're seeing rental prices coming down. That could be some deflationary pressure as well. So overall, putting it all together, we've had a strong equity market in the second quarter, but a strong equity market together for the last 12 months. We've continued to see volatility in the fixed income market, but that does give us an opportunity to enter back in fixed income markets with yields a little bit higher than they have, with the potential of coming down over time. Any discussion, comments on the economy? You expected news, right? We had positive news on equity markets, positive news international, domestic, positive news fixed income. Our portfolio is up. We're showing the 1 month on page 10 up 0.5% versus policy, quarter to date. So end of June, we're up 8.6%. Putting our fiscal year at 10.22, target again is 6.75%. We have an update that we'll talk about I'll just kind of spill it here though. Since the end of quarter, we're up now at 12% plus for our fiscal year to date return. Strong, meaningful performance. Again, our long-term target is at 6.75. We've created a portfolio, we'll talk about that when we get to the asset allocation piece, to try to get to that 6.75, take out fees, and then also reduce risk with manager selection. What have we done for the fiscal year? We go to the historic asset growth in the middle of the page. For the quarter to date, total funds started with $50,500,000. Added, we had a contribution of $251,000, fees of $64,000. Then we have our income of $346,000 for the quarter. Add that to $4 million, so it grew by $4.3 million and $55,060,000. Quick reminder though, to stay in that area, that box in the middle under historic asset growth, we are in net distribution. We're paying payable retirees, being paid, the money coming into this plan. So we look at the 1 year number, we sent out $1.6 million net of city contribution, employee contributions out of this plan over the last 12 months. So when we talk about risk management, that's what we focus on. If the market is down, protecting up and down in down markets, that has a smaller effect during those times of volatility. So always remember we're in that distribution mode, trying to protect assets in times of volatility. Last piece on this page is alpha. I'm at the bottom of the page. Fourth from the right, we have inception date, R squared sharp, alpha gives positive alpha. When we focus on risk management, we want to see a positive alpha. When we look at our managers on the traditional side, all of our managers have positive alphas minus one. So they've been doing their job, living up to that long-term expectation that we want to manage risk, we want to have participate in up markets, protect and down, create this alpha over the long term. And we've accomplished that at total fund and at the manager level as well. When we look at allocation on page 12, we've been overweight equities, that's a positive. Slight underweight to fixed income, slight underweight to the alts. If we go and look at page 13, we've been making a decision to lean into value. So on page 13 at the top, our large cap value weighting is almost 18, 17.5%. Our target's 15, and we've reduced our large cap growth weighting. We're now at 13.5 versus 15% target. Everywhere else is pretty close. International growth is a little bit above or a little bit below on the fixed income side. Private real estate is a little bit below, but that's been a decision not to add that to it. But we're not taking money out of real estate anymore. So everything else is fairly close in line. We'll talk about allocation and rebalancing towards the end after we have our full discussion if we want to make any adjustments there. And I'll give some guidance as well. So we're to the managers. I said we'll go quick. I'll slow down on a few managers that we're going to talk about the details and why, but it's going to be a theme across the board. You're going to see one-year performance for most of our managers below the benchmark with long-term performance above or with a positive alpha. So our first manager, page 14, is passive. We have a passive manager with an active manager. So page 14 is the passive piece. Page 15 is our active manager. And you can see over the last 12 months, below the benchmark, long-term, a little bit below the benchmark, but we're taking on significant 10% less risk. So if you look at that alpha number, positive alpha. We know they're a little bit more defensive, JP Morgan is. So we have JP Morgan paired with a passive investment. As we've seen, the large cap value side, technology is up 85% in that benchmark for the quarter. JP Morgan participated just not up, they're not as concentrated as the benchmark. So keep it up, still long-term good numbers, have that paired with asset management. In the large cap growth space, we have passive. We know it's really tough to, in the large cap growth asset class, to outperform when that market changes quickly. So rather than having to change managers frequently, on page 16, we have a passive piece, and we only have passive in large cap growth. Counters, page 17. Here's that story, continued the last 1 year, a little bit weaker, long-term above the benchmark, positive alpha. and now since the end of the quarter, they're above the benchmark. We're seeing that shift since the end of the second quarter. Quality matters. We're seeing AI growth sell off a little bit, and we're seeing good performance from the managers since the end of the quarter. Next page, Kennedy. We're going to do a deep dive on Kennedy, but we'll just point out the one-year number is up 18%. If I said that alone, we'd be happy. The market's up 26%. Long-term, though, still above the benchmark. We've been adding almost a percent per year for a decade above the benchmark. So annualized long-term performance has still added money to the portfolio, positive alpha the last year, a little bit weak. We made a change over the last 2 years, over the last year, that our mid-cap growth on page 19. So over the last year, a little bit below. Lower risk. How we're going to measure risk is at the bottom. We have a manager name, return, standard deviation, beta. That's our measure of risk. That beta is 0.78. That means when the market's up 10%, we should be up 7.8. When it falls 10%, we should go down 7.8. So very protected. 20% less risk than the market. Since the end of the quarter, this is really important, the market is down 2% in the mid-cap growth space. Federated is up positive 2%. That's what we hope for. Kayne Anderson, small cap value. If we're going to have a discussion about a change after, this might be the manager that we will bring a search for next quarter. Look at the one-year number here. They're up 3. Benchmark's up 43. Below the benchmark for the last decade. Still positive alpha again. They're 20% less risk. So as this market's changing into this quarter, they're not the mid-cap value. Small-cap value is still positive. The benchmark's up 2. They're up 1. So if we're going to bring a search, and when we look at the data, if we kind of push into that, hey, we might want to replace them. And maybe it's going to be a conversation of how we do that. And I'll bring ideas back. But that is the one area where when we have a deep dive, we go through the data, we might come to the conclusion that, yeah, this spring search, we'll talk about what we want to bring to that when we get to that point. RBC, page 21, it's the same story, below for the last 12 months. Long term, above the benchmark, annualized performance, 1% above the benchmark for the last almost decade. Positive alpha, since the end of the quarter, the market's down 1.5. They're down 0.25%. So market volatility's picked up on the growth side of the equation, and we're getting the protection that we expect from the managers on that side.
Morning, TJ. Excuse me. I just want to make one comment. First, a complimentary comment. The presentation section, I really like it in terms of the asset allocation piece in the first section before we got to the portfolio returns. But the one thing that I want to point out, just to be clear, is I think if we go back to three of the funds, okay, forget Connors, but like Kennedy, the mid-cap growth, and then Kayne Anderson, in particular, you've kind of made the point that the long-term performance is over 10 years, we're still outperforming the benchmark, et cetera. But then if I look at Kennedy, the 1, 3, and the 5-year numbers, for Kennedy and then also Kayne Anderson, we, clearly are underperforming on Kennedy by about 122 basis points for 5 years. The gap widens over 3 years, and it's very wide over 1 year. So, I think, to be fair, we need to point out the fact that the outperformance over a 10-year period occurred over 5 years ago, and then there's been significant underperformance from the 5 years to the present on Kennedy. And I think the same thing holds on, Kayne Anderson is just bad. You started to talk about the RBC Small Cap Growth Fund. And the same thing, holds true in terms of long-term, performance looks good, but if you look at literally everything from the 1, 3, and the 5, it is bad. So, one, I wanted to bring that up, and two, I think set the stage for what you were alluding to, which is contemplating changes to the allocation and the manager searches. So just to be fair.
And just point out that those three-year numbers are included in those long-term numbers, right? So that's, those are the long-term actual returns. So if we replace any of the managers we're talking about, X, Kane, and this Kane, we would have, and weren't passive investments, we would have had a lower, we would have had lower dollars in this plan if we did that 10 years ago. But because we have that, because we did have Kennedy, because we did have RBC, we actually have more dollars than if we were in passive, because that inception number does include the one-year performance as well. So the short-term performance, yes, is under, but that is fed into those long-term numbers as well.
Well, no, I understand that, but that's my point, and this is where I would disagree with you, because you know, if we would have stopped investing in these and 5 years ago, for example, and again, I realize you can't go back into history and say 5 years ago what would happen the following 5 years. But, you know, definitionally, you can break this 10-year return number into two periods. You know, the 5 years between the present and 5 years ago, and then the 5 years from 5 years ago to 10 years ago, right? So mathematically, if we've averaged 1.9% on Kayne Anderson for 5 years versus 8.24% for the benchmark over the past 5 years, then we clearly would have had less money in the plan than if we would have just invested in the Russell 2000 Value Index. And so, like, yeah, I know that you're saying the 10-year annualized return takes into account the 1 year or so forth, but I'm saying there's a clear distinction mathematically between the returns of the time periods. So I would, you know, posit that we seriously need to contemplate changes to a couple of these investments.
The good news is I brought all that right down, John. We'll go to that next. So those are great points that we need in the next conversation.
No, I knew you would. Thanks, buddy.
wrapping everything up, Todd, we just hired a year since the end of last year. Since the end of the quarter, again, it's just a theme shift we're seeing. Todd's up 5, the market's up 1.5. So we're seeing that change. Newer manager, we're seeing the positive results since the end of the quarter. Renaissance, we've had discussions about Renaissance. I'm on page 23 for some time. They've turned around. You know, negative alpha, below the benchmark long term. Last year, though, above the benchmark, up 39%, one of the best performers in the portfolio. Fixed income, page 24, doing what we would expect, up 4.5% over the last year, in line with the benchmark, above slightly. There's not a lot of room to add a lot of value in the fixed income markets. We're pretty basic, down the middle with specific, in line over the long term, positive alpha. Again, this is kind of a buffer in the portfolio. If there's some income, if markets did fall, rates came down, it would be a buffer in an area where we could raise cash if that did happen. Center Coast MLPs. Strong performance over the last, you know, fiscal year, 1 year. This is why we do have different asset classes. Really strong performance from Center Coast MLPs, positive alpha, no comments there. American Core, we're seeing real estate markets turn around. Boost bottom, I guess, is what we would say, because the last 3 years, we still have a negative return, as we've seen repricing in fixed income markets as interest rates have gone up. It's been putting pressure on real estate. We've seen not only interest rates, but the working from home from 2020 to 2021. It's put a lot of pressure. Before that, retail. But over the last year, we've seen some stabilization. We're now at least getting our income. It produces 4-5% income for us, and it's a diversifier. When 2022 was going on, markets were down 20%. ACR was actually positive. So it does provide that as well. It provides income and diversification. Next couple pages is the new asset classes we added, private equity. We have about 1/4 worth of data here. JP Morgan private equity of 5.86. And then on the next page, we have private credit. We spent some time earlier this year talking about private credit. There's been a lot of pressure, conversations, a little of that has calmed down. You're not hearing, you're not seeing as much pressure. You're not seeing what we call the gates or everybody trying to get redemptions. And we are in what we like to call private credit light. We didn't go into, you know, highly leveraged managers. We're using a high yield benchmark, which is not the best benchmark. We do have a peer group benchmark we're going to add over time. But if we look at what we're looking at on Blackstone Private Credit, page 28, we look at the bottom, this is what we hope to see or what we'd like to see. Let's go to the up-down. Again, it's one quarter. Data's not great, but during the quarter, fixed income, we talked about rates going up. So fixed income was negative at one point during the quarter, but the fixed income was negative. We're halfway across the bottom. You see up capture, you'll see down capture. When fixed income was negative, this manager was positive. Still earning yield, still above, and the same is for Scion Aries. So again, 3 months for the data, for some of them, Blackstone, private credit, Aries, private credit, a little bit, came closer to a year. It's just a part of the market that we're watching as interest rates volatility is picking up. Scion's going to be a little bit more volatile because they do have not only private credit, but public credit as well. So that's why we're seeing that negative return for Scion Aries compared to the Blackstone, which is purely private credit. But we still think it's a good part of the portfolio long term. There's a lot of volatility in the space over the last 6 months to a year. Putting it all together, again, page 30, this looks at our actual dollar-weighted return, net of distributions, net of fees, net of paying for Ron, paying for actuaries, paying for administration, us. That is net of all distributions. What did we actually earn on the plan for our dollars? That's what Doug cares about. Our fiscal year now is 9.8%. Above that 6.75%, we have, what, 5 weeks, 6 weeks till the end of the quarter, in the fiscal year. On pace, looking good to meet that actuarial assumption. Next page, just all the information put back together. Page 34 is our IPS checklist. We look at our investment policy. Hey, are we doing what we say we're going to do? Are we in line with our investment policy, rules, and regulation? Are we in line with statutes? Yes, it's across the board. And then the last page, page 35. Look at that bottom right. Since the end of the quarter, we've added another 3% at 12.14%. We are slightly overweight. As you imagine, equity markets are up. We're overweight equities by about 4.5% our target. We're overweight large cap value by 3, underweight large cap growth by 1.5. So that spread between value and growth is about 4.5% difference when we have a target equal weight. A little bit overweight Renaissance, international growth by 1%. And we're underweight fixed income. I didn't put any recommended changes today until we're going to have a conversation about asset allocation. Through that conversation, we can then come back to this and say, what do we think? Instead of pulse, I have some ideas about, you know, markets again near all-time highs. We have about $650,000 in cash. We could, again, a little bit under our target there, a little under our target in fixed income. Typically, when we have a good run, we do like to raise some cash, take a little chips off the table, make sure we have enough money for the next 12 months to meet our obligations, which we still would. We have about $1 million of income that comes in a year, and we're spending about 1.6. So we're still in line to be able to make our contributions for the next year. It's just, what do we want to do? And we'll have a discussion about that, I think, after we talk about asset allocation. But that's the performance presentation. Any other comments before we jump into the details?
Is everybody happy?
Absolutely. Good performance.
Strong performance. I'll set the stage on the next tab. First is going to be the set the stage active versus passive, and then we included details about the managers to show that it's not always been below the benchmark. To John's point, yeah, it's been long term, it's been really recent performance. So we're going to demonstrate that as well, and then we'll have a discussion, hooked up a discussion about where we're going. So I'll go through this first tab two relatively quickly. I'm going to take a little bit of time. Bottom left, there are some page numbers, small page numbers. I'm on two. It's going to say manager versus universe return. What this page shows is it takes the whole universe. It takes all the mid-cap value managers. And it breaks it down into quartiles. So looking at the left-hand side of this page, that white section is top quartile, light gray, second quartile, lighter gray, medium gray, third quartile, and the dark gray is the bottom quartile. What we're showing is a 36-month, student math, that's a three-year rolling return. And we're going from left to right. If we look at the below the chart, you can see from 7/2023 to 6/30/2026. That's a three-year window. We take off a couple of those years in the next column. So now from 2021 to 2024, take 2 years off, 19 to 22, 17 to 20. So we're rolling. We're not, it's different time periods, different chunks of three-year periods. And what we're showing is how did the benchmark do compare to active managers? And what you'll see is recently, that blue box is in the second quartile, above, doing better than majority, over 50% of the managers are below the benchmark for the last 3 years. The previous section, that when we looked at 2021 to 2024, almost 75% of managers did better than the benchmark. Same for the period after, close, about half from 2017 to 2020, almost again, three quarters, 15 to 18, but then the benchmark did well, 13 to 16, 11 to 24, and 09 to 12. So those last three sections, the benchmark was looking better. We said, great, that's over a three-year period. There's times when the benchmark does better. There's times when active managers do better. How does that look on a five-year rolling period? Next page, bottom left, it says three. Over the last 5 years, half the managers have been better than the benchmark, half or below. Periods before, 75 better, 75% better, about 50% better for this 2015 to 2020, 2013 to 18, three quarters. And this kind of rhymes with the previous page of 2 years back in 2016, and from 2011 to 16, and 2009 to 2014. Why is that theory similar to where we are now? If we look at 2011 to 2016, 2009 to 2014, the benchmark did better. What were we coming out of starting in 2009? The great financial crisis. So when we look at the period before, most managers did better because they focus on risk and risk management. And coming out of those periods when the market does poorly, that's when we usually have these beta type rallies. So where the benchmark does better than managers as it comes back off that bottom, you can, the market's down 40%, it's coming back 20-30% over the next couple of years. So coming out of times of stress, we do see passive do better. Coming out of 2022, passive has done better as 2022 there was some pressure on the market, market's down 20%. So that's what we've seen in the mid-cap value space. We provide this for both now mid-cap growth, small-cap value and growth, and it's going to be a similar story. So from page five, mid-cap growth, again, it's going to be the benchmark towards the bottom. Drifts up over about 50%. And on page six, similar story. We go from the three-year rolling on page five to the five-year rolling on page six. The mid-cap growth space, benchmark on a five-year, tends to be at best around the 50th percentile when you see the active manager perform well over the long-term in that space. Small cap value on page 8 is going to look very similar. 3 year basis. Recently, that blue square has popped up, beating most managers over the last 3 years. But the 3 years prior, the benchmark was towards the bottom. Popped up in 2015 to 2018, the 50th percentile, but consistently near the bottom of that range or that of active managers. And you can see on the five-year number on page 9 now, the benchmark, most managers in small cap growth tend to outperform the benchmark on a five-year at small cap value. Small cap growth, page 11, looks the same. So there have been times, especially in the mid-small cap space, where active managers have done better on a five-year basis rolling return. We do kind of see active managers do better. Where we have it is that most recent period on the left-hand side where we're seeing from 21 to 26. It goes back to that first page in the capital markets we've seen over the last 5 years, PE expansion. If PE expands quickly compared to earnings, our managers focus on earnings. PE markets are these beta, what we call a beta-driven market. We do tend to be a little bit behind. So when we go to the next tab, it's just setting up to look at our managers on a rolling period. So we took our information for our managers, starting on page 6, we're showing Kennedy. This is under the next tab, tab 3. On page 6, the bottom line, page number 1. This is going to be in line with what we talked about earlier, with Kennedy, over the long term. Over the last 10, since inception, above the benchmark. Net of fees, what we're seeing over the last 7 years is Kennedy be below. So now let's look at the rolling, let's look at historic periods. And if you go to page 7, we're looking at calendar year returns. Over the last 3 years, up at the top, we're showing year to date, 25, 24, all the way back to 2012. Top line is gross returns, middle line is manager fees. Kennedy charges us 0.35%. So if we're comparing net of fee performance against that bottom line the last 3 years, this has been where a lot of that underperformance has come from. We're above in 23, a little bit below in 22, above 21, 20, 19, 18 a little bit below, that was a tough year, 17, 16 above, 15 a little bit below, 14 above. So we're showing 15 periods, they're splitting about 50-50, half the time they're above, half the time they're below. But if we go to the next page, now we're looking at that same three-year period of rolling returns. We're saying, okay, Kennedy, if we combine these annual performance numbers, how have they done on a rolling three-year period? Take one period off, add a period. So I'm looking at the bottom, top graph, it's too busy, it's me, cross-eyed. But if we look at the bottom and we go to the middle, Kennedy mid-cap management with X fees, net of fees, 35 basis points. So that white line in the middle compared to the bottom line, Kennedy's a below for the most recent period. The last 3 years, we just talked about, yes, last 3 years have been tough for Kennedy. The previous 3 years up, above. Take a year off, add a year, above. Take a year off, add a year, they're above. Take a year off, add a year, they're above. So going back to 2016, on a three-year basis, they were above. It's been the last 3 years of letting that five-year number that we were just looking at, focusing on, and they've had consistent long-term above the benchmark. It's been the last 3 years. And on the next page, we focused on risk and return. The last 3 years, two time periods, their alpha has been below the benchmark. But over the long term, they've actually had positive alpha. Showing that then on page 10, 15 years since inception, risk characteristics as well. But we just want to show they've been consistent. It's been the last 3 years where we've really had a struggle from Kennedy.
Okay. So I have a question. I mean, this is interesting data, and I've got some other points to get to manager suggestions or so forth. But it's nice to see the rolling periods and then the calendar year performance versus the benchmark. One of the things that strikes me, though, is the last 3 years is where there's been significant underperformance. And then, you know, there were a couple of periods before that where it was outperforming, underperforming, et cetera, right? So I'll take the point that this is probably was a good investment. And then it looks like something materially changed about 3 years ago to start delivering the meaningful underperformance. So do you know, what was the cause of that? Was there some sort of style drift? Was there a change in the portfolio management team? You know, what was the catalyst for them literally starting to underperform? Because I can kind of understand that, all right, if the decision was made to underwrite and evaluate an investment under a certain basis for why we would want to have them in the portfolio, I accept that, right? They perform. But then if something has changed that could perhaps allow, I mean, facilitate like questioning the thesis of why we invested in them, I'd be curious, you know, to know, because if like things change, then that could be a catalyst for making a decision to change the manager.
Yeah. Three P's, performance, people, and process is what we focus on. Performance has fallen off. That's why we're having this conversation. Okay, we have something going on. People have been the same. We haven't had a manager leave, manager changes. Process is the same, and process is leading into the performance differential. And the process is they focus on cash flow of these organizations, the cash flows of the companies that they're purchasing and buying in. They're looking at the free cash flow that they're able to reinvest in themselves. And that's going to be a theme for all the managers we've used in this portfolio. And if we're seeing equity markets not reward the revenue side and the earnings side of the equation, like we've seen over the last several years, that's that PE expansion. It's not been the E side we've been focusing on. It's just been risk on market, focusing on AI, booming out those companies that are now oversized in a lot of the benchmarks. They don't, that is where we tend to see them on the floor. And I look back to the 09, 08 numbers as well. You come out and now earnings matter in 08, 09 coming out, everybody's jumping back to the market and getting PE expansions coming back in. So it's I think a conversation about did we leave too much on the table in the last 3 years? Now, the last decade, we've still had good performances, added dollars to our plan. Is it, you know, I'm fine with passive in the portfolio. I don't want to come across that I am advocating that we should have active and only active, and that's the way to go. We have plans that are 100% passive. It's really about a conversation we've had as trustees historically, what we've looked at in the plan and what we're trying to accomplish. Focusing on, we want to own companies that have positive results, have positive earnings. 50% of these benchmarks in the small and mid-cap space, 50% of the companies don't have earnings. So when the managers look at the universe and they say, we want to have companies that have positive earnings, half that universe is thrown out, and that's really what's been driving the market is a lot of these companies that are reinvesting, not having earnings, and more on the growth side of the equation when we've had managers that focus on the equity, the income side of the equation. Now, we're seeing some of that shift this quarter as, you know, multiples have, I wish I had a better story for the quarter on all of them as multiples came down on the large cap side, but we've seen multiples still expand on the mid cap and small cap side until this recent quarter where the growth side started to come down. We're seeing good results from our growth managers this quarter. That's a long-winded way of saying, could we add a piece of the portfolio, small and mid cap passive, in addition to them, we could. And that kind of smooths out some of these differentials we see right now. Is it a, let's replace everything with passive? That would change the course of what we've done historically. Open to it, I'm just making you aware of these are the reasons and we made decisions long term. We've had really strong performance, still have good performance over the last decade, but those are the rationales and reasons behind why we made these decisions historically. Now, with active management, there is going to be times like this where we say, we should have been passive. Do we think it's going to continue? Potentially, we're seeing a change right now. We're showing that there's been times historically that this has rhymed with what we see right now. We've seen these managers come back. But it's more of a conversation, John, I think, from the standpoint of, are we open to have this conversation? What does it change? And are you open to adding passive to the portfolio? Absolutely. This is the reason why historically we've done it. Is it easy to time and say 3 years ago we should make this change? Looking back, when earnings came down and or PEs contracted in 2022, and if we knew that, you know, we're going to have a recovery, yeah, that could have been a good time to enter into passive as we come out of those type of stress markets. So is it now the time to do it when we're at all-time highs, or do we wait for another event where markets are down 10, 20% and then start doing it? That's a conversation as well.
Well, I think, I mean, one of the things that was very valuable in the presentation that you presented was those charts that showed the percentage of managers in the universe that actually outperformed the benchmark. It wasn't what I expected, to be honest. And I thought that what was particularly compelling about it and what registered in my mind was given that you've got a small cap universe and a mid cap universe, there are those markets are more inefficient than large caps, right? And so I think that logically it makes sense that in a more inefficient market, an active manager can add more value than something where if it's a large cap stock, you just go on, you know, you buy the index, right? So relative to last meeting, I think this is a compelling piece of evidence that you presented that argues in favor of active management. I'm surprised, you know, myself, but it was a good piece of material. And I think a discussion, we should have a discussion about, did we actually pick the right manager? Because when I saw, you know, 3 months ago when I was looking at the performance numbers, I thought, you know, Kennedy is bad. We should just go passive, right? But then the evidence that you've shown today indicates, yeah, Kennedy's still bad, but there are probably other active managers out there that are better, and we don't necessarily need to go to passive. And, I mean, I think it's consistent with the philosophy that the board has had to utilize active management. And it probably makes more sense to, you know, obviously have a conversation about passive versus active. But given that the long-term theme has been, philosophy has been focused on active management, you know, maybe an issue to consider is just finding a better manager. So, yeah, I mean, so thank you for the slides. Helpful.
Well, to piggyback on that, the only way to really look at this would be to find other managers, active managers in the same universe and have the same chart and take a look at it that way. Have they all had problems? Or is there one who stands out in every period, you know, head and shoulders above the rest? We've done that before, but that's really the only way to do it. So, I mean, the first thing is to say we're going to go with an active manager versus a passive manager. And if we come up with active, who are the other players? Let's take a look at them, make a comparison. It takes time. We're not going to meet till November, but over the period of the universe that we're in, it's not going to make a difference not being able to do it today.
I think 3 months gives us a little bit more time as we've seen the shift as well. So we come back in 3 months, I did everything for all the managers. It's going to be the same story, right? It's going to be recent underperformance, half the time over the long term, they've split returns, rolling periods above, below, very similar to what we just covered. I don't think we have to go through the details there. That's what we'll do is we'll come back next quarter, add to this, and we'll skip most of the conversation about the rationale behind it, but let's focus on, okay, is there something that's more consistent, and is there another way to do this? Are we with the right team? Are we with the right management style? Let's consider all the management styles again and just refresh, and they'll give us 3 more months of data. Add that to what we have now, so that'll be 5 more months from where we are today. I think that'd be a great conversation. And again, I think we'll have really good performance through the end of the fiscal year. We can be briefing again on the managers next quarter and focus again, getting ready for the second tab and go to that comparison. And then we can also talk and look at passive in that conversation as well. What would happen if we did add passive? So I think that would be warranted at this point. Agree?
Satisfy you?
Yeah, I think okay. That makes perfect sense.
Anybody else want to weigh in on this?
That's a good idea.
Yeah, agreed.
Okay.
Last tab, just we were talking about, you know, we had a conversation about is 6¾ the right number? That came last quarter. We talked about potentially reducing it to 6. We did a study at 6, and we're at 6¾ right now. And, you know, we're talking about in near term, intermediate term, and the long term thereafter. Is 6¾ the right number? I don't know if 6 is the right number. I think, you know, markets are at all time high. Six and three quarters, is it closer to 6? We asked, I think, Doug, take a look at that. What's the effects of that? But what we're showing on page bottom right, last tab, tab 4, page numbers 1 of 24. We took our investment policy and said, okay, if we're investing in our investment policy today, based on all our targets, what's our expected return? The second page, 2 of 24, shows the results of that. So that first page, just all the targets. We talked about the targets earlier. We just took it out of the investment policy, plugged it into our tool. And then it spits out what our expected return is on 2 of 24. And what it shows is the assumptions, and it has two columns, strategic and secular. What's the difference? Strategic is what we think over the next 7 years, and secular is in over the long-term normal market cycles. So what we're showing is an annual return expectation for the next 7 years. Now, it's not every year is going to be this, and we'll get to that in a second, but over the long term, we're presenting current 7.8% is our expectations. Now, garbage in, garbage out, right? All this goes out the window, earnings change, all that. But based on our forward-looking, which takes into consideration long-term numbers, but really focuses on where are we today and how do we adjust for what we believe is going to be what the market looks like going forward. So 7.8, that's gross. We take out, I think, all in fees for our consulting fee comes out, our manager fees, custody comes out to about 55 basis points. So we take 0.5% off that, gets us 7.3, with about a 0.5% margin on that 6.75. Now we've gone through this study and how did this, we went through this, and that's how we landed at private equity, adding private credit. We went through this and showed that if we add these different asset classes, we reduce the risk, which is that second line now on page 2 of 24, standard deviation, 10.6. So what that leads to is the probability, the last line there, of a positive return is 77%. So 3 out of 4 years, just over that, you should have positive returns. But what I like to focus on is now if we go to page 7 of 24, you said, okay, what is our expectation? What percent of the time should we be over 6.75? With our current mix, 61% of the time, we should be above that number. 72-73% of the time above 6%. Over the last 10 years, we took the allocation and said, what did we earn or what would we earn? We know it because we had it in our book, but 9.7%, looking back historically, on page 8 of 24. But the big piece, I like to show this is on 9 of 24 and 10 of 24. What happens to our portfolio when volatility does pick up, when the market does fall on page 9 of 24, 30%, we'd expect our portfolio to be down 17.9%. On page 10 of 24, during the global financial crisis, markets were down 50%. Our portfolio could be down 35%. I mean, we could draw from $55 million down to $36 million. On top of that, we have to draw now 4%. We still have to pay that $1.6 million to distributions on top of that. That would be another 4%. So we'd be down, our portfolio would be down about 4%. So when we talk about manager selection, now we've diversified to protect on the downside. That's why we're not down 50%. But managers in that environment should add some additional savings, not just being down 35, but add some protection. But that's where we are today. I think the conversation of, well, do we think in the near term, you know, equity markets are expensive, basically looking at multiples, what is our expectation? Go to page 11. This is a busy page, so I'll try to make high level what we're showing here is our expectations. We show strategic, that's over the next 7 years, at the top of page 11 and 24 on the left-hand side, we show annual returns, and you see equity markets, we think, are going to be 8.5%, where annual returns in a normal long-term market is 9. So we do believe there's some muted return expectations for the next several years, but still have strong single-digit returns. We think fixed income, if we go now halfway down that page on the left, black box on the left-hand side says fixed income, 4.8%, we believe, over the next 7 years. Our long-term is under 4, if we go to the right-hand side of this page. So we think fixed income markets are a little attractive right now, given where the yields are, given expectations of possible rate decreases over the next 7 to 10 years. So if we go back and say 6.75 is the right number, we believe so over the long-term. Now, could next year be down? Yes. But we talked about that last meeting, high markets are tough. We can't be right all the time. Go back to 1996, the Fed said equity markets are overpriced, took 4 years. Having diversification, a diversified portfolio helps mitigate those downside risks as well. in reducing actuarial assumptions, again, goes back to the city having to put more money into the plan as well, right? So I think what Doug's going to come next year, and we have, maybe do 4 years to move, right? So 4 years to move, 2022 is going to come off. And we're going to have a pretty, really good looking actuarial number. I mean, really good. I'm going to guess high single digits, if not low double digits returns. And he's going to suggest reducing rates. Why? Because if the city's already paying in, it's going to be a reduction of the city's contributions. Yeah, right. It's a good thing to have. But at the same time, he's saying we're here, and we know we're drawing this plan down on the long term. Right? This is a, we're sending money out, and that's going to increase at some point. As more retirees find benefits, his goal is to continue to reduce the actuarial assumption over time. Then our goal, as for me and us having a conversation, we're showing that we're earning, what, close to 8%? Do we keep the actuary, the assumptions the same? Do we keep the allocation the same? Or do we reduce risk? Because now are we shooting, if the actuarial assumption is 6, do we want to reduce our assumptions out of 6, go to fixed income, more to fixed income, or reduce risk? Those are the conversations we're going to have around that actuarial assumption. So two separate pieces, the actuarial assumption set for contributions from the city, how do we fund this plan, make sure it's long-term, they're assuming we're going to get 6 3/4, and we fund to that. And then our discussion is, do we want to reduce risk and meet that expectation, or do we continue to have some sort of gap between that expected return and what our expected return is on this? So that's just kind of an indication of where we landed with the asset allocation, why we're where we are today. And if we do reduce rates or the actuarial assumption, do we then become a little bit more protected in the portfolio? And that's a conversation we had as well.
So you know how I feel. You lower the expectation, then you lower what you may be able to do with the plan, because you're going to look at that number, that bogey. I like to look ahead. I make it 12. You know, shoot for something that's beyond the stars. Because for me, in the end, I want to leave this town with a lot of money after they paid off all their bills. So, I mean, because at a point we could give this and just take out an insurance policy, and we'd all be gone. We wouldn't have to be here and talk about this, and the insurance company would be laughing all the way to the bank, because they're not going to do it unless they think they can make money. So I don't like lowering that number, because everything else seems to fall into place.
And lowering the number does two things. One, the city contributions go up. Two, if we lower the number but didn't change our actuarial assumption, it reduces the city's contributions because now we're beating that more handily. So, no, I'm in the same camp as you, Rabbi. We have them on the hook. We're making it in. I think the conversation is, you know, are we still comfortable at 7? I think so, especially now where markets are. I don't think adding risk is the only way to increase that. If we add risk, we increase risk more than we are return. Become a little bit less efficient. So at this point, if we had an event like a 2022 or a 2008, it's going to be hard enough talking about adding back the equities of 2008 or 2000. So those are the points where we talk about adding risk, not when we're at all time highs. That's a long way of saying it. We still like our targets long term. I think we're still above our expected return for the actuary, and we've been meeting and exceeding that. So I think, from my perspective, we have the right allocation right now. It's really, again, going back to the asset allocation piece, where we are today, the updated values, we're making decisions on the margins around those targets of where we think there's still some value and where would we reallocate dollars. So I think it's staying the course of what we've been doing is to continue, is the right course to continue, and making those modifications when we talk about asset allocation on the updated values page.
You guys are quiet.
Yeah, that's good.
Well, you've mesmerized them.
Friday morning.
And we kind of were pushed even a little bit to lower it last time because of the state.
Yeah.
The state comes in and says, "Oh, you're too rosy. You're and so we're going to make you." lower it. I mean, they kind of threatened us, if I remember right.
Yeah, the pressure
okay,
is coming.
If you don't lower it, you know, we're going to deem your plan.
There's no question it's coming
from that
state.
So hopefully in the future, that's not going to happen again. I don't, you know.
They can deny our letter that we send, you know, which states what we've decided on. They can deny it. They can they can force us. I believe. Am I right, Ron?
Yes, they can force. But if I can, about what usually happens in connection with that, we are required by law to have an actuarial valuation at least once every 3 years. And when the valuation, and we do it more often, and when the valuation is complete, we send it into the state. And the state reviews the valuation. And they're supposed to do it at least once every 3 years and then tell you whether your valuation is state accepted or not state accepted. When they want you to lower the assumed rate of return, what they customarily do is send you a letter and say, we want you to think about lowering the assumed rate of return. It usually takes quite a while before they say you have to lower the assumed rate of return. We do not get 175 or 185 money anymore. That was their big hammer. You know, they could withhold those insurance premium tax monies. They also, with a plan that doesn't take that money, they can withhold revenue sharing funds, which can be significant. And if it ever gets to that point, and I haven't seen it get to that point in any of the plans I've represented, you can push back at that, but you will have a time, you will have a chance at that time to lower your assumption. They don't just send a letter. Customarily, this is the way they've always done it. They just don't send a letter and say, you have to lower it right now. It's a process that you go through. And they want to engage with you on that. That's how it usually happens.
A letter is signed with a name and a wink.
Yeah. You know, we've had some, they say, with our calculations show with your portfolio, you won't receive, with your that asset allocation, you won't receive that assumed rate of return. And one of my plans wrote back saying, can you please send that to us? We'd like to see, because, you know, the manager, the consultant thought we could, and we just never did get an answer on that. So I'm not saying you don't take those seriously. If you get them, you take them very seriously. But that starts a process that can take a long time. And they will want to hear from you why you're not doing it and so forth. You can't ignore them.
But really, it's only going to happen at once every 3 years anyway, right? When the evaluation, when we have to reevaluate things.
Well, I don't know when.
At any given time.
Well, I'm not sure when we had our last letter. I can't remember approving our valuation. There was a time they couldn't keep up once every 3 years. But the letter that you're talking about is a common letter that a lot of plans get. And the plans consider it.
The good news now is we're in line with the FRS right before we weren't. So they're not targeting us right now. We still have some plans at 7.5. They're looking at those plans. I think we're in line with where FRS is. I don't think we received that letter from the state now. I'm telling you, Doug's going to come and say, because we had such great actuarial valuation, you might want to consider it. It's just going to come out of his mouth. But we can consider that because, again, we'll have that great actuarial number. He's going to say, look, the contributions from the city went down, if they're used to paying it, I've seen through this time and time again, it's going to make that suggestion. If you want to consider it, now is the time to consider it.
So I think with respect to the issue of lowering the actuarial assumption, the return assumption, right, as we're talking about, I think there's two ways to go. And I think you have to start with looking at if we have the current asset allocation and don't have any changes to it, what is a realistic expectation given the current market environment for whether or not we're able to generate the 6.75. And I think one of the reasons why Doug brought this up to lower to six is taking into account, my recollection may be foggy, but taking into account the fact that we may be entering into an environment of diminished forward returns, right? So one thing you can do is you say, keep the current asset allocation roughly the same, but lower the return expectation if we think forward returns warrant that. The other way to do it is to say, you keep the 6.75 and then change the asset allocation to increase the likelihood, given today's market conditions, what investment mix will give us a greater likelihood of hitting the 6.75. And I want to point a couple of things out, right? Which, it's great to look at the secular the 7-year forward return outlook. The current value of the U.S. stock market is 238% of GDP, and that's the Buffett indicator. And it is extremely overvalued, and the long-term historical average is 166%. So whenever I sit and I look at the 8.3% annualized return for next 7 years in terms of that expectation, I say poppycock. I don't think it's going to hit. I mean, this is like, because for that to continue at that 238% GDP ratio, we'd have to have, for that ratio to remain constant, we'd have to have 8.3% GDP growth and 8.3% increases in the stock market, right? And that just isn't going to happen. So I really think that like the return expectation over the next 7 years for U.S. equities is too high, number one. Number two, if you look at Treasury yields today, the 30-year Treasury yield is at 5.2%, right? And it's the highest it's been since the summer of 2007. And the 10-year is at 4.72, I think, highest since, again, the summer of 2007, with the exception of, like, 2023. And the trend is up. The U.S. government has $40 trillion in debt. We just hit the $40 trillion mark earlier this week. Which is up, I think, $10 billion since the first Trump presidency, $10 trillion, right? So I don't think that – I already made my point about the equity returns. And then the fixed income returns of, 4.8% per year, I don't see how that's going to happen, because in addition to the fact that we've hit a point where Treasury yields are as high as they have been in 19 years, combined with the size of the national debt. And then you look at where credit spreads are, which are historically tight, and I have them, but I'm not going to state it at this point. I don't understand. I don't see where, in order for us to hit a 4.8% annual return for fixed income, we would have to see Treasury yields themselves decline meaningfully so that we could have total return potential from falling bond yields. And then we'd have to have credit spreads continue to tighten even more dramatically than they're already at. And they're already at, secular lows. So the one thing that I would do would be, I would argue one of two points. Right. I would propose this for all of us that are on the board. You can think about, do we want to keep it at 6.75 and then really assess if the portfolio is designed to capture that 6.75%? Or do we contemplate, and I know it's not until the next meeting, consider lowering it to 6% and again, asking ourselves, do we have the right portfolio mix that's going to generate six? Because I think at a macro level, without even getting granular, if you have a situation where stocks are extremely overvalued relative to history and bond yields are rising to a level that they haven't been in 19 years, those are serious issues to consider in terms of whether or not we have the right return assumptions. No.
Your fixed income is one part, but it's a small part of this portfolio. I mean, I've always, my belief is this, that even you, with a hedge fund,
sure,
you're not big enough to sway the markets to go up or down. David Tepper, they made a whole thing of how he emptied his portfolio and he put all his money in these three giant. But did that make a difference in what happened that day? He's only one person, and there are more billionaires in the world playing around with money today to try to sway the market. But I don't think any one person can do it, not even Warren Buffett, if he was still active. So,
I mean, look, I'm sorry, but I don't understand the analogy, because one thing that I would say is, like, if you just go back and look at the fixed income returns, fixed income is 23.5% of the portfolio, give or take, right? And fixed income over the last, like, 5 years, I'm not going to be able to flip to it in time, but it's underperformed cash, right? So literally, like, you know, let's look at the return assumptions that are in the book, and then let's look at the historical returns that the portfolio has actually generated from the asset class, and ask ourselves the question, you know, is past performance indicative of future results? And should we even have 23% in this fixed income product, given that literally it hasn't been meeting our return assumptions? I mean, what's been driving the success of the portfolio over the past, you know, 5 to 10 years is that we've been in an equity bull market, right? And that is going to stop at some point in time. And it's great that, you know, we're in the funded position that we are, and then we have, you know, the historical performance relative to the 6.75%. But I ask the question, and again, what I do with my own, you know, investments is not applicable to what the board does with the pension fund.
I understand. I'm just saying,
you know, literally, let's take into account and question the return assumptions that are in the book in the context of actual financial market conditions.
So what I'm trying to imply is that if we were driven into a recession by bad policy, this board has no way to go like this. We can't stop it. We're subject to what happens in the greater world. So we can only deal with what we have and look at a historical picture of where did we start and where are we today, and has this fund grown, or has it only been relying on the money coming from the town? And the answer is the money coming from the town was their choice, the way they did it, to amortize it instead of putting the money away at one time. So they pay every year. But if the Magnificent Seven today, as we're talking, suddenly go through the ceiling and we're making a lot of money, we have no control over that.
Well, I guess my point is that that's already happened, and that's why the stock market's at 240% of value, and why tech, you know, represents roughly 40% of the value of the S&P. So, you know, the question to respond directly to your point is that, you know, yes, if tech continues to, you know, go to the moon, then we would make more money. But what is the likelihood that that continues to happen, given the run that it's been on and the level of historical valuation? I mean, because, you know, the town can't eat on past performance. The town eats on what we're actually able to generate in the portfolio, you know, today and for the remainder of the fiscal year and the next fiscal year, et cetera. And so the question that I ask, you know, fundamentally is, you know, what happens if the tech bubble bursts? What happens if bond yields continue to rise? And, you know, we may very well say, and I'll stop in a sec. We may very well say, the market's down 30%. We want to put money back into equities because the forward returns look good. But where is that money going to come from, right? So, anyway.
I think it's a very important discussion. And I think every time that we look at the total picture, we have to keep that in mind. The fixed income portion is a big portion. It's not minuscule. You're talking almost a quarter of the plan. It's big. I see where you're coming from, but.
It's a question of timing. It's just you're questioning the forward look based on what you see market conditions doing and maintaining that percentage. Is the concern that we only meet every 3 months? That's not enough time to do the allocation corrections in 3 months from now if we start to see that shift actually happening or that bubble popping over time?
No. I mean, I'm not, you know, advocating for something other than making decisions on a quarterly basis when we have the meetings. I think that there is, a need to evaluate the way the portfolio is constructed and allocated in the context of where, returns actually look like they would occur, or, you know, on a going forward basis. And I think we're at that inflection point because, I'll look at I want to pull the fixed income up, right?
Well, that's really boils down. You think we are at the inflection point. I think that's what it boils down to.
Correct. Okay. Let's see. Okay. I want to find the fixed income portfolio for a second. All right. That's equity. That's what page is it?
32, 33 plus everything together. If you're looking for return, yes?
Okay, no, I found it. Okay, so if we look at the...
John, which tab and what page?
Page 24 on tab 1. So I'm looking specifically at the Pacific Income Advisors, right? So... The 10-year annualized return for this portfolio was 2%, right? 10 years, 2.01, 7 years, 2.04, 5 years, 1.43. We had a nice little pop 3 years ago when spreads, fixed interest income rallied.
Yeah, yeah.
It was up 4.6%. Now it's 3. Like, and then you compare that to, I think, that's a significant historical, underperformance that is being relative to the 6.75% compared, and that's been, and we've hit the 6.75% because of other investments in the portfolio, right?
Well, just pause there for this, because we were underweight this asset class at the low end until we saw rates come up over the last couple of years. So the reason we are seeing underperformance, we're underweight during the 10-year period. We've had rates go from, we'll call it 0 to 5, in a 3-year period, 2-year period, and now we're earning, 4% yield in the portfolio. So, yes, we can look at 10 and say it's underperformed, but going forward, we're not having rates at 0. Our expectations aren't for rates to go to 0 from 0 to 5. Even if they go from, let's call it 4.5 out of 10 years to 5.5, we're not going to have negative performance because we are earning that 4%. So it's a different environment than even 3 years ago when rates started going up.
I guess my point is this, like, I'm not arguing about relative performance. I'm making the point that the absolute return performance in the fixed income sector has been low in an absolute sense. I'm also making the point that says there's a distinction between the total return that you get on a fixed income investment and the yield, right? Sure, we can invest at a 4.5% yield, but as you so eloquently made the point at the beginning of the meeting, if rates go from 4 to 4.5%, then the rabbi's got to sell his bonds at 98, right? So we're going to lose money on the price return that needs to be subsidized by the yield in the portfolio. And so when we look at the total returns in the sector, they're low, and we may even be yielding 5% today in that portfolio. I don't know, right? But given the trajectory of interest rates, when we look at the total return for the measurement period, if rates continue to rise, that total return will be less than the yield, right?
So what I hear you saying is, let's consider where we are today. We've set the bar. We said, here's where we are. The equity market extended, yields continue to rise. TJ, is there ways that we can take and hedge some of this? Is there, what would your suggestions be, TJ, to say, okay, if you believe that those in the near term could be overinflated returns? Now, 8% maybe, you know, market falls, it comes back, you know, 2008 took 3 years to recover. We want to start to de-risk from asset classes that are having volatility or potential for volatility. We can take a look. So we did that a little bit on the private side. It's still equity exposure. It's still fixed income exposure. We haven't talked about different alts in a while. John, maybe that could be a solution too, is, hey, maybe we can find some sort of hedge strategy that has fixed income-like risk characteristics with a lower, with it still a 4% to 8% return profile that is different from those. Could that be part of that conversation in expanding out asset classes that we're using?
Well, I would make, if we just stick with the current asset allocation that we have, right, or the mix, rather than saying let's add a new asset class into consideration or something like that, I would suggest probably three changes that I would ask you to look at, right? One would be, you know, what is the impact? We already made part of the shift last meeting or two meetings ago where we cut back some of the large cap growth and reallocated toward large cap value. So we've been shifting that. You know, I would ask you to consider researching a continuation of that, because large cap growth is extremely expensive right now, right? That's one thing. The second thing I would ask would be, can we consider different weights than 2.5% each for mid-cap growth, mid-cap value, small-cap growth, small-cap value? Because, I mean, it seems like the logic for putting 2.5% in each of those four was just to make it like round numbers, 2.5%, right? Without taking into account the potential return outlook of that. And maybe you up it to 5% each of those categories and you cut the large cap growth. I mean, you do the work, right? Figure that out, right? But I look at the 2.5% in those four sectors and I wonder, what's the logic behind 2.5%? Maybe we should be increasing that. And I think a benefit to that is the exhibit that you showed, given the percentage of active managers who outperform the benchmark in small and mid cap equities, that seems like a way to consider hitting our return targets. A third consideration would be looking at increasing our exposure to international equities at the expense of domestic equities, based on valuation and the fact that the dollar is problematic, to put it mildly. And then the fourth would be, do you cut the fixed income allocation from 22.5% to 15 or something like that, right? And as part of that cut in the asset allocation to fixed income, do you look at other managers that are potentially better? I mean, and just two to
that. Would it be a yield, I mean, duration consideration as well? Would that help?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to opine on duration, okay, right? What I'm going to opine on is, one, I just think from a macro perspective, do we consider decreasing the fixed income? Because I think that we're in a rising interest rate environment. Okay. But more specifically, like, okay, Pacific Income Advisors, you know, why haven't we done anything with PIMCO or Double Line, for example? And so, because I have more confidence in PIMCO and Jeff Gundlach at Double Line than I do PIA.
Yeah. It's been a boring fight, right? I mean, if you look at the PIMCOs of the world, the Double Lines and what they're doing, it's a little bit different. Say it gently, Pacific. It's just been a balance of the portfolio more than a fight from absolute return. And I think, you know, if we want to consider that, what do we mean by absolute return? We do other things within the portfolio, and PIMCO and Double Line do this. Having a conversation about how they manage different than PIA, Pacific Income Advisors, and that is a conversation, and it's probably a good point to have that conversation as well with our outlook looking forward. But I think all that, if you go back to page 35 in that first half, and I think, you know, what we've been doing and what John's talked about, if you look at the top of this page, the top left, there are two large valley managers followed by growth. And we look at the bold section, total large cap value, and start working our way across, we're at 18% value versus 15% target. We're underweight by 1.5 on growth. Now, if we go down to the next bolded section, total equity, we're at 64.5. We're overweight by 4.5. Underweight fixed right now, underweight a little bit on the cash side of the equation. Now, the conversation, previewed this, and I think we've had a lot of great discussion to lead back to this, and I think we're to the point where we can discuss, you know, are we willing or are we to a point where we want to rebalance here the 4.5% overweight to equities, given, you know, expectations about volatility leading up to an election, some softness in earnings recently, some outlook reductions. Do we take that off, start again, selling high, buying low? I'm open to that conversation because that's what we have been doing, right? We've been reallocating out of equities when we have a good run. Allocate back into fixed income. You know, is rates going to continue to go up potentially? But if rates at least levelize and stocks fall, fixed income should be better than stocks in that environment. So I think getting back to equal weighting, I don't want to touch international. To John's point, I think from valuation standpoint, international looks better than U.S. What is valuations? We can go back to the price to earnings and talk about. We haven't seen the same run up in price to earnings in international. We're starting to see some of it. We're seeing strong earnings there. You know, the dollar could be weakening, which would be a tailwind for us as well. So I do like international and what John previewed there on alignment with. So I think if we're going to make some changes, I would reweight fixed income just to get us back up to target, reducing our equity exposure. It's our fixed income, get our cash back to target, and I'd be okay leaving international, if not adding maybe a percent to Todd International at this point to get an equal weight with value versus growth, so we're overweight that asset class as well. But that's just me, broad strokes, looking for feedback, and then I think we can kind of fine-tune that. I think we would do that, and kind of keeping in play with what we've done recently. So Pacific, we're under by 1.5%. Cash, we're under by, let's just call it half. So we're talking about moving 2% out of equities. Maybe we reduce where we would keep the overweight in equities, I think would be then to the international piece, have 1% overweight in each. So that would keep us at overweight equities, but we're in a lower valuation asset piece of that. And then the conversation is, okay, do we want to take any from large cap value or do we take from large cap growth to accomplish that?
I mean, I would, again, disagree with you. Always respectfully, of course, but I would cut more of the large cap growth. I would not touch the large cap value. And I would put it into the international and, you know, split it 50-50, like value growth. Like, I don't think that really matters as much as taking money off the table from large cap growth, which is 40% tech stocks when you have a 238% stock market to GDP ratio. I don't agree with rebalancing into the fixed income. I've already made the point as to why. I would further actually cut fixed income from 22% down closer to the high teens. And then I would probably redeploy some of that into international. And then one thing I would ask you to do, we didn't even talk about this, and this is another dog in the portfolio, but the American Core Realty private real estate, you know, can you evaluate that in the context of, for discussion purposes, how that's performed relative to like the Vanguard real estate, you know, in that like mutual fund, index fund, right? I mean, because if you look at the actual historical performance numbers of that real estate product, I think they're on par with the fixed income and they're underperforming cash. And it just, and we have a 5% position on it.
Can you get that done for us for November?
Yes.
Okay, so it'll basically be a discussion on this asset allocation and where we can tweak it. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, TJ.
TJ, anything else? How are you tired?
Is that smoke coming out of your ears?
I think we got it.
Whoops, okay.
You didn't have anything else today to talk about Kane Anderson. You're going to bring that back with your whole comparison next time? Yeah.
Okay. How does going forward to be able to bring the right information? So we'll bring that to the next meeting.
Yep.
Thank you, TJ. Okay, Ron?
Yes, thank you. I want to just report on a recent court decision that has a bearing on something that this board did and the city did, the town did several last year or the year before, having to do with the cost of living adjustment for the general employees. You will remember the police and fire have a cost of living adjustment, but the general employees do not. And a number of general employees came here asking for a cost of living adjustment. And the board asked me if it was legal to do, and I said it was certainly legal for the active employees, but there was a significant question about whether it was legal for people who had already retired. I reported at that time that the Attorney General had issued a number of opinions saying that it wasn't legal to do so, but Attorney General's opinions are not binding on the court, and they're just an attorney's opinion. They're an important attorney's opinion, but they're just an attorney's opinion and not binding. A number of trial courts had ruled that it was okay to grant an increase in benefits to people who were already retired. And said that there were going to be appeals on that. And there were appeals, and it's a recent case from Dade County out of the city of Doral. What had happened was the council voted to create a pension for themselves. And then several years later, they repealed the pension. And four council people brought suit. And the court ruled that if you had retired before the ordinance went into effect, if you had retired while the ordinance was in effect, you won. But if you retired before the ordinance was in effect and you were trying to give money to people who had already retired, you lost. So the ruling now in the state of Florida, and it's based on a particular statute, and the statute says that no extra compensation shall be made to any officer after the service has been rendered or contract made. So it had appeared in the 1868 Constitution. And in 1968, they took it out of the Constitution, made it into a statute. So the board was correct and the town was correct in not granting the COLA to people who were already retired. Now, there is another case on appeal that in a different district court of appeal, the 6th in Florida, that may reach a different decision. And as I said, it used to be in the Constitution. Now it's been passed by the Florida legislature. And there's already a move to repeal this particular provision. It doesn't always, and one of the reasons is a quirk with 175 and 185 that you don't deal with anymore. But those say if you're fully funded, you can't get your chapter money anymore. You can't get the money from the state if you're fully funded. So what a number of plans have done is said, you know, we're going to take whatever money comes in and distribute it to all the retirees, and that'll keep us, you know, 99% funded. And that's thrown into doubt now. But anyway, the rule of law in Florida right now, and while it may change, and I'll keep watching this, but we had spent some time on this, you all remember, is that that particular statute says that an increase in pension benefit or a pension benefit is compensation, and no extra compensation can be paid after the service has been rendered. So I just wanted to close the loop on that, and we'll keep watching if there's new cases. We watch this issue carefully. It's an important issue.
So the motion that we sent to the town commission, which they ultimately passed, is in effect?
Oh, it's absolutely in effect and is legal. And you know, some of these people had retired while it was in effect, and they won. So yes, it's absolutely in effect. Your advice, when we discussed a legal issue, your advice was, let's be cautious on this. Grant it to those that are active, which are fine. I mean, COLAs are not, they're a common feature of pension plans. The idea is, get it while you're here. I mean, that's the message to the employees. Get it while you're still working. If you don't get it while you're still working, you're not going to get it later on, no matter how much purchasing power has increased. You know, some people are talking now just to, well, we don't call it a COLA. We call it an inflation adjustment. And we say, we're just going to pay the same amount of money. We're going to pay more money to a person to give them the same amount of purchasing power. I've heard that suggested. You know, if your purchasing power has gone down by 18%, then you'll get that. I can't say that's okay under this court ruling. You know, if a court says it's okay, it may be. But under this court ruling, I couldn't say that's legal.
My view is that what we now have is better than what we had for those employees.
Oh, absolutely. I think that this board and the town did the right thing on this.
Thank you, Ron.
Okay, and that's my report.
Any questions of Ron? Okay. All right.
Mr.
Toby,
Chairman?
I know you've been waiting with bated breath.
I have just one question, Rabbi. In connection with the pension, the old pension plan, at the November meeting, could we perhaps get the unfunded liability position? I know we've been closing that gap. Our investment performance has been helping a great deal in that. And I'd just like to see where we are in November, that unfunded pension liability position on the old pension plan. Could we put that on the agenda?
Absolutely. We can put it on the agenda, but who is that? Who's going to be responsible for doing that?
I can get it from the actuarial report, the latest one.
Okay, great. Thank you, Sue. Okay. All right, Toby.
Sir, can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
You've got the 2027 proposed meeting dates in front of you. I'll show you a review of them. You guys look over that, and if there's any discussion or conflict that you might have. But we're keeping in line with the current rotation that we had in 2026. That's my understanding. It would be, for the record, February 19, 2027, May 21, August 20, and November 19, all at 9 a.m. Something like this.
Mm-hmm.
And Rabbi, I did check with the town clerk. This room is available for all those 4 days.
Okay, good. Thank you, Sue.
Thank you, Sue. That makes this a lot of
Have you got anything on that cyber best practices update for us?
I do, Mr. Chair. If we could just get a motion to accept these days, if there's no discussion on it, that would be great.
Motion?
So moved.
So moved. Second?
I'll second.
Second. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? You've got those dates.
Thank you, sir. Yes, I have an update. I spoke to Scott Bauer. He spoke to John Keane. They both feel that the cybersecurity is very low risk for the town. If the board wanted to do anything extra, the board would consider a cyber policy, which we can create for the board. But they feel confident that based on this closing plan, the low risk, there's nothing else needed, is what came out of that conversation. I think they spoke for over an hour, Mr. Bauer and Mr. Keane.
So the recommendation is for us to do nothing?
To consider that you're fine as you are now, you're safe, because all of your service providers could either conduct a SOC 1 and SOC 2 audit, or at the very least, a SOC 1 audit. And so the money going back and forth is protected, or as protected as it can be, and believe the town feels comfortable with that. Certainly the IT director felt fine with that. So you're fine the way you are. If you wanted an extra layer, we can have a discussion about a cyber policy, but
we have any idea what the cyber policy costs annually?
Well, that's not what I'm recommending. What we would be recommending is to have a policy added to your administrative operating rules as to how you're going to go about ensuring that cyber is protected with any future service provider or any renewal contracts, as opposed to hiring a third-party vendor to oversee cybersecurity when there's such a low risk. The cost doesn't factor in. I don't think it would be fiduciary responsible person to it at this point, based on the conversation that they had. I don't know if Isaac, if you had a conversation.
I had a brief conversation with Jason Keane. I think Toby summarized that Jason, our IT director, is comfortable with what's already happening with the private firms to meet those security levels.
Okay. Yeah. Is this something that we would, if we decided to do it, to protect our pension board, or would this be town-wide?
I don't know the answer to that.
Because it just seems to me that maybe there's an umbrella that the town would want to consider that would protect every piece of the town of Longboat Key. I mean, we're independent, but we're not.
So the town already has multiple levels of cybersecurity protection, and I believe we have a cyber policy if we get hacked or ransomed. So we already have that.
Okay, so we would fall under that.
Does the committee fall under that?
Yes, I would say so.
Yeah, so we're okay. That's partial also why he has little less concern, our IT director.
Well, it's the difference between me wearing a belt and me wearing a belt and suspenders.
Yeah, I'd say we probably already have the belt and suspenders. Okay. It'd be some third measure.
Okay. Thank you, Toby. No,
thank you, sir.
Anything else?
No, sir. We move on now to item 5.
Okay. Plan financials. We have, hold on. Okay. Anybody have any questions about this information? There's nothing we need to do on this. This is just information for us, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Now we do have warrants.
Yes, sir.
Where am I? Here they are. In the total of $47,332.65.
Correct.
Okay, so we need a motion to approve these expenditures. All right.
Motion to approve.
Okay, motion made. Seconded.
I'll second, but I do have a question. Why some of these warrants go back to April and they haven't been acted on? Why are we doing that approval today when it probably should have been done 90 days ago?
You want to be more specific?
Well, I'm just looking at the top ones, you know. Disbursement date was the 23rd of April, and we have two in May. We have some in June. I would think we would have acted on those earlier, but I'm not sure how the timing works out.
Well, they may have come in too late for us to act on them in the prior meeting. I don't know. It's a great question.
Exactly. it happened, it would have happened after you guys have already met. Sometimes, especially with the FPPTA, the disbursement happens a little later. And so that's my, I can triple check to make sure that's 100%, but I think that that's what occurred here.
I mean, just because there's a date on it doesn't mean that we got it in time for us to act at the last meeting, even though the last meeting was in May. So
okay.
I think this happens almost on a regular basis. If you go back and look at the warrants, there have been many that have been backdated that have a day prior to the last meeting. We didn't get them until this meeting.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so I have a motion that's been made and seconded. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carried. Okay.
We also have a benefit approval, Mr. Chair.
One second. And this benefit approval is for Kerry Brooks. Am I right? That's the only one, right? Okay. And this is really not something that, this is sort of pro forma, you know, and having a discussion on something like this. It's a person who worked and retired. So you need a motion for this. Can I get a motion to accept the benefit approval for Kerry Brooks?
Motion.
Second. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carried. Thank you.
Who was the second? I missed it.
Huh?
Who was the second on the motion?
Second was over here. Yeah. Hold on now. I got so many papers here, I can't keep track. Hold on.
Next is the update on the RFP and recommendations for old business, actuary contract renewal, and the legal service agreement.
Okay. Well, that's old business. Do we have any new business? No, I think the new business is going to be what we've already agreed on, which will come to us at the next meeting from TJ. Okay. The update on the actuary contract is here. I'm assuming you've had a chance to read it. So just to review, there was a special committee put together of four people, two from this board, two from the town, and we went through four proposals from four companies, Foster and Foster, Smith and Company, Cavanaugh McDonald Consulting, and the Howard Nyard Company. They all had put forth proposals for us, and there was a full discussion. It was a long meeting. And in the end, based on the vote was taken basically by each person who was there, voted based on a point system for each item. And Foster and Foster came out at the top. You can actually see the difference in the average. So they were the ones recommended. And the contract really is something that the town does. So do we have to approve this, or the town's already approved it? Do you know?
Yes. No, that's good. No, that's what I was going to say.
So we need a motion to recommend this to the commission.
It would be to the town manager.
Town manager. Okay. Yeah. So do I have a motion?
I'll do a motion.
Motion made. Second.
Second.
Second over here. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carried. Must say, was a, you know, you deal with the actuary, and we've gotten used to Doug Losen from Foster and Foster. He's part of the team. But when you go through this, it is amazing to me how completely different and almost in a different universe some of these actuarial firms are. I mean, we're used to having Doug here basically when we want him. If we need him here, he can get here. But one of them promised us that they would make an appearance at least once a year.
Gee, thanks.
It was an eye opener, I must say. Okay. and a legal services agreement renewal. Where is that?
Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chairman, if I could just be heard for a second on that. So I've been your lawyer. October and November will be 10 years on two separate contracts. Each was 3 years and then a one-year renewal options that the board has. And the rule used to be that after two contracts like that, you had to go out for RFP. They've changed that. Carrie Kennedy told me they changed that as to legal, so you don't have to. You certainly can. I wrote an email to Scott and Carrie Kennedy saying I thought it should be on the agenda. And if the board didn't want to go out to RFP, I made an offer that I would continue to work at the same rate I have, which is the same rate I've had for 10 years. And with that said, unless there's an objection, I'd like to step outside like I customarily do when you discuss me. Question. Yes, sir.
So now I'm confused because you also work for the town.
I do work for, but only as a result of my, I don't work for the town. I work for this board. The town does the contracting. The town has trusted me to sign as assistant town attorney for your contracts. Does that?
Well, I'm still confused.
Okay.
Will this board be voting on offering you a contract?
Yes.
So it's not coming from the town commission?
No.
And they will then approve what we've done? Is that the direction that we go in?
The town manager is a contracting agent for the town.
Okay.
And
but he will not do anything until this board makes
correct. Correct.
Okay.
And then I would prefer not putting in an RFP, but if you all want to go through that process, you certainly have the right. I just wanted to make
personally
clear
I do not want to go through that. I think we have someone who's really, really good and knows what he's doing. Right. And that's what I want for everybody who works for the board. So if you want to step out
I
for
do.
A second.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Don't go too far.
This shouldn't take too long.
Walk fast.
And turn around and come back in.
So I believe there's a town exception that allows for no RFP to be done. You guys are happy with
that's
correct.
Is there anybody here who is interested in finding a replacement for Ron?
Nope. I don't know. Ron, did he drop the ball today? He didn't bring them cookies with Scott. Not here.
I'll bring the cookies. You keep Ron.
Maybe we can use that to get a better rate.
Yeah.
Does someone want to make a motion to rehire Ron and Gloria Moore?
Absolutely.
Motion made, second.
I'll be happy to second.
Yeah. Second, we have any discussion?
Just a question, my goal would be yes, but when does this term expire and the renewal? I believe it's 2-3 year terms. The initial contract would be for 3 years, and then the town has the right to re-up for additional 3 years, and then that's what kicks in the RFP for the rest of the contract. It's my understanding.
So like, so he's on a contract now, and when does it expire? And when? Like,
3 years.
Well, from when? Like September 30th or?
Is it pending expiration? Is that what you're asking? Like, when is it going to expire? The current contract,
sure.
Contract.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm
sure he knows.
Usually these things happen where
it's be coming up if it's the
expiration date is in front of you and you want to make sure that you don't have a gap, because if we didn't rehire him and have to go out to look for someone else, it's cumbersome because you're now going to be dealing with multiple.
It's around November,
a lot of
I think.
Interviews, and it's kind of hard with an attorney, because it does involve the town. I mean, it's like an appendage to the commission is if they hire him as the assistant town attorney. So it's a little bit more cumbersome than finding another actuary.
Sure. Yeah, no, I'm not debating that. I'm just generally curious
right.
as to when it's...
Yeah, I don't know the expiration.
Ron on
the... He'll tell us.
He'll tell us the date.
All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Carried. Okay, thank you. We have to go get Ron.
I'll go now.
All right, Ron, pack your bags.
your history. It's been nice knowing you.
Ron, there was some discussion in here about cookies or something, and they seem to be missing today.
Ron,
one of our new members.
We added it to the contract.
We did have a question I couldn't answer. When is your contract up?
Your current contract.
October or November. I don't know the exact date. Yeah.
So, the only thing we would require in this new contract is that you leave that god-awful place of Weston and come west so you're closer to us.
I'll let you talk to Mrs. Cohen.
That may not happen. That provision might not make it.
Ron Mazeltov.
Thank you very much.
With us for quite some time.
I appreciate the relationship. I appreciate the confidence.
Well, we're glad to have you. Board comments.
I'm going to the conference, and I think somebody else is. And is that the first week of October? The last week of September.
Last week of September. Yeah, I think the
27th. In Orlando.
The 30th.
Where is that one?
It's in Orlando.
Orlando.
Yeah. Okay. See, I don't know. You passed all the courses.
Yeah,
I have too. Yeah, so it's for CEUs.
Yeah. Last time I came back from Orlando from one of those, I got COVID for a month. So.
Boy,
don't breathe while you're there.
Don't breathe.
Any board comments? I have one comment. I don't know how this happened. Oh, this is February. Okay, no, forget it. No, November 20th. It should be November 20th, not August 21st. For some reason, on my copy of the agenda, I have August 21st.
That was a prior.
I probably printed it off early in the process. Okay. Any comments from the board?
No.
I want to thank you for, I'm being serious. I think it's really, really,
it's really
important
healthy discussion.
To take a look at things, you know. You raised some really interesting points, so we're going to see where it takes us. I appreciate it. Do we have a move to adjourn? A motion?
So moved.
So moved. Second?
Second.
Second.